Now, welcome to another inspiring edition of Sound Insight with Dr. Tom Curran.
Well, I want to welcome to the program Dr. Abigail Favale, and she is joining me today. Are you joining me today from the Portland area or from the middle part of the United States? I know that you've been moving around a bit here. So, Dr. Favale, where are you these days?
I am in the middle part. I'm in South Bend, Indiana. So my family and I relocated here in 2022. So it's been almost exactly 3 years. Since we moved from the West Coast, from the Pacific Northwest, you know, my husband and I are both from the West. So we miss the land there greatly, but we really love the community we've found here.
That's tremendous. And you're a professor at Notre Dame University, yeah. Which is tremendous. What a gift. And we're thrilled that I'm here today to talk to you about Our Lady of the Sign, this beautiful novel that you wrote, was released just recently by Ignatius Press. And when I saw that it had come out, I said, oh, I need to get Dr. Favale on for reasons that you don't know. But here we go. The first is my daughter was at George Fox University. And
oh,
so, yeah, a very devout Catholic woman. And so a bit of a paradox because she would go to traditional Latin Mass and she was the worship leader at Saints Hill Evangelical Church all on the same weekend.
Wow.
How about that?
Oh my goodness. That's amazing. Yeah. I was at George Fox before I came to Notre Dame and taught there for 12 years. I'm also an alum. So I really love that place. That's very cool. I've converted to Catholicism while I was working at George Fox.
Well, this is a fascinating thing because she would look at you at a distance with some kids in tow, and at Mass she'd see you. And she was always like nervous or hesitant to go up and talk to you. So you were a bit of a heroine to her. So,
oh my goodness. Yeah. That's so sweet. Oh
yeah. So when I told her I was interviewing you, she's like, oh, wow, I can't believe it. That's so awesome. So little did you know that she, living out her Catholic faith in a very reverent and profound way on the campus of George Fox, found in you someone that was a real blessing to her to be able to live out your Catholic faith in that environment. And so, and she graduated with a degree in English writing. So she,
amazing.
Yeah, she's a budding author. So
that's so wonderful.
Yeah, isn't that cool? So, so I got the book and I started reading it and I'm like, oh, this book reminds me of De Trinitate by St. Augustine.
Really? Okay. I want to hear more about why you think that.
Yeah. Okay. So much of what the contemporary Catholic theology focuses on regarding we're created in the image of God focuses on the fact that we're created with intellect and will. Mm-hmm. So, and a lot of folks will draw upon Augustine to say that we image God as having an intellect and will, or the capacity to reason and human freedom. But Augustine in De Trinitate identifies the psychological image of God by focusing on the interior acts of the mind, intellect, will, and memory. Mm. Memory is God the Father. And memory is the capacity to make what is past real and effective in the present. Mm. And as I was reading Our Lady of the Sign, I don't know, you can't really see it, but I have so many notes in here, wow, all the way through the book, marking up pages and just identifying memory, past becoming real in the present, past obscured in the present, past being blocked by the present, and how that's connected to imagination and that's connected to sleep. All of these themes that are swirling around in your book was frankly amazing. And so I just wanted to put that forward to you and just say what I just mentioned about the reality of memory as this fundamental capacity that we have in our lives, that you consciously, intentionally wove it in. It was like a tapestry, or I think the word I used was a diamond with many facets. Like, folks, if you want to understand a bit about the reality of memory and the many facets of how it plays itself out in our lives, you've got to read Our Lady of the Sign. So there's my opening question.
Wow, that's so cool. I love that. I mean, I love St. Augustine. He's definitely been very much an influence in my life. And I'm more familiar with his writings on memory from the Confessions. But you're right, this novel is very much about memory and memory as a kind of self-narration in a way. And we can have false and true, I think, memories or narratives about who we are and what our lives have been. And so in many ways, the story is about a protagonist who is kind of drawn into the past, drawn to go back to her past, to the place where she grew up. And once there, she becomes kind of trapped in a way by and begins to wrestle with memories, because there's a version of her past that she's told herself and been told, and this kind of other narrative of her past that begins to break through in ways that she doesn't expect or want necessarily. So, yeah, memory is definitely a key theme.
Well, what I found, one of the things that I found so attractive about your book, about this novel, Our Lady of the Sign Against, published by Ignatius Press, folks. And I'm going to have you go to ignatius.com to be able to access the book. And we're going to give out Abigail's Substack as well over the course of the program. So, folks, don't worry, you'll be able to access more of her writings as we're talking today. Is that when you discuss this reality of memory, you do so from the standpoint of a character that is sometimes, I guess, surprising. There's a surprising way that you're not choosing a devout character. You're not writing a book like Mr. Blue. I felt more like you were writing an early Walker Percy novel, where you're getting inside a character that is fundamentally different from you, and yet there are so many elements of the main character, Simone, that I think is probably evocative for you in your life.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a work of fiction, right? But I think at least as a writer, especially a fiction writer, I like to draw on what I know. Right, kind of bring that to life, but also to play with it in ways that aren't necessarily totally accurate. So it does take place in a region where I grew up, which is Eastern Idaho. So it takes place in this very kind of isolated, snowy, rural Idaho town that takes on some kind of allegorical themes as well and is kind of spiritually evoking a sense of fallenness and exile. It's the town is called Fall River, and it's actually a real river, but it's just named perfectly for the kind of spiritual reality I wanted it to evoke. And yes, the protagonist is not religious. She is a pretty secular, professional, works as a professor, right? Lives in Oregon, right? So you can see some of the connections with my own. With my own kind of experience, but and I used to be secular, right? So I've only been Catholic for maybe 11 years now, and so I did want to get back into the headspace of someone who sees reality as one plane only, and that's just the plane of the natural world, right? There's no supernatural world that is breaking through and trying to reveal itself to us. And so I wanted to get back into the mentality and the way of seeing of someone who doesn't see past the realm of the natural. And so that's who the character is, right? And she begins to have in the novel these encounters with the supernatural, and she's not really sure what to do with them, right? She's not sure, is this my imagination? Is this a dream? Am I going crazy? Right? Or is there actually something real that's trying to get a hold of me, and so that builds some of the tension, that ambiguity between what seems to be real and what isn't real.
So, and the way that you don't you do the kind of the gentle, slow unveiling of like what's going on in the circumstances, like referencing the bag from the very beginning, but then you reference there's something in the bag, and then wait a minute, it's about pills, and then wait a minute, why is she going there, right? So this unveiling of things. And we're not going to, do any big giveaways, but we do want to be able to help folks understand that even if I mentioned or we end up talking today about some of the ultimate happenings in the novel, the journey of walking through that novel is so very powerful. Because it'll do two things, folks, and this is what it did for me, is that in reading your novel, I'm not only reading a story that you're helping me walk through, but there's that whole psychological dimension, right? The whole dimension of going inside and letting the book shine a light on my life. So I can tell you, just for instance, just before we got on this interview, I was having a call with someone. And some of the themes that you talk about in the book, in the novel, Our Lady of the Sign, were relevant for the conversation. There's a kind of a famous book called of Understanding Trauma called The Body Keeps the Score. And I thought of that book. I thought of that book as I was reading your novel and how the body was keeping the score. And it was driving her and impacting her without her realizing it, and yet she's trying to like grasp at it. And the one of the techniques that you used, at least this is what I picked up, was the number of times in the novels when she would meet someone and they would ask a question: "Why are you here? What are you doing here?" Or in Adam's case, like, how did you get here? Right? That again, the many facets of asking this question. I just found that really, again, delightful and insightful. So I just want to, again, just I'm throwing it back to you.
Yes, I'm excited to see that you kind of are picking up on some of the smaller little Easter eggs, I guess, that I was laying down. Because as a writer, you never really know, like, is anyone going to get this? Is anyone going to notice this pattern? Or is this just sort of something for my own enjoyment?
So Abigail, just that idea of sort of hiding in plain sight these insights about, I call it a fundamental question. The fundamental question of why are you here? I found so striking in the novel. And I love the fact that you had planted those, you call them Easter eggs. But just that idea of fundamental questioning and how I connected it back to this idea that the body keeps the score, that sometimes we don't know what it is that's driving us. So just talk about that, like that's just that dynamic in life.
Yeah, and this goes back to the theme of memory, right? Because there are things that we, and I'm not here talking about like repressed memories. That's a very sort of controversial idea whether things can happen to us that we kind of completely repress. But I'm more thinking about maybe things that have been kind of lost in the shuffle of the memory that aren't really totally conscious, but then suddenly will break out in kind of a sudden way. Like, oh, I had forgotten. This encounter with this person and for Simone, who is just to kind of describe the story a little bit for the your listeners. So she has gone back to her hometown after about 15 years away. So her mother moved away after she left after she left home. So she's just gone back there actually to rent it because it's now an Airbnb. So she's going back to stay in her old house, but now someone else owns it, right? The furniture is all different. And she had kind of expected this feeling of homecoming, but instead she's feeling a sense of like alienation and dread in a way. So there seems to be like the past is coming at her in a way that she didn't expect. And she often is kind of experiencing this in a very embodied way. So there's almost like a disconnect between what she ha consciously has held on to from the past and then what her body has held on to, right? And so there's kind of
Well,
the layers of
it
the
bubbles
body.
up. You use the word reunion. Like that was the first word that she uses to identify the meaning. But the funny thing is that she has no idea what she's saying. Like
Yes.
she doesn't realize what reunion is going to actually mean, and with whom is this reunion going to unfold? What's it going to be involved? I just love that. I'm like, that's brilliant.
Yeah. And even the fact that she goes back, she doesn't even know why she's going back, right? I mean, she has this secret. She has kind of a double secret because she has a secret from her past that she's kind of put to rest and has thinks that she's done with. But then she also has this secret, this dilemma in the present that I'm not going to reveal because it drives kind of the tension of the first part of the novel. But she just has this sudden urge to go back to this home, and it's not even until later that she begins to really realize why, right? So there's almost like there's kind of like this bodily urge to go there, this like instinctive urge to go back to that place in order to kind of go through the dilemma she has in the present. But She's not aware of any of that consciously, you know. She's just acting on impulse, really.
Well, and it's interesting. Again, I'm talking with Dr. Abigail Favale. She is an author. She's a professor. She is at Notre Dame University now, and she's on maternity leave, enjoying time with your new baby. Congratulations to
Thank
that.
you.
And the author of the novel, Our Lady of the Sign, that we're talking about today, folks. Again, you can go to ignatiuspress.com, or just Ignatius. Sorry, ignatius.com is Ignatius Press, where you can get this book, Our Lady of the Sign. I don't have a lot of time in my life for fiction, but book is so worthwhile because it's for me the best kind of fiction. There was a stage in my life where I enjoyed popcorn novels, so you could just kind of get through them. This is more like a fine meal, right? It was
Good.
the other author that I mentioned, Walker Percy, was another author that this one evoked because of his very first novel. What's that called? Gosh. But the character there was very much akin to
Is it
Simone.
the moviegoer? Is that his
Yes, the
first?
moviegoer. Yes,
Yeah.
thank you. Yeah, again, I don't know if these authors have any influence on you in terms of your thinking and approach to a protagonist, but very
No,
fascinating.
I'm very flattered, like the idea that, you know, my work would evoke Walker Percy. I have started to read his stuff, but not I haven't read a bunch. But I do really like it. And in some ways, I think my because I'm so glad to hear that you said that it was like a meal because it's not a long novel, right? And I really also wanted to write it as a page turner. Like I wanted it to have a sense of I wanted it to be a, yeah, I wanted it to be a story that's good just for its own sake, right? But then also for the reader who is attuned to some of these more in-depth themes that are at work, they would really find so much there. And so it's encouraging to me to hear that that's exactly kind of what your experience was.
I did, and it wasn't obvious, right? It wasn't obvious, and yet there were pointers, right? So I'll come around to it, but she has two encounters of going to mass, and discovers Miguel, and how Miguel becomes an interpreter for that one of the visions and the spiritual visions she has, to contrast it with her friend Cass, who is describing this encounter. And I have to admit, when I first, excuse me, when I first had Cass describe, Cass was her best friend growing up, and that's one of the reunions that ends up happening. And then again, that's where you start having this unfolding of, wait a minute, there are memories here that she doesn't have until the encounter with her friend breaks it open, and all of a sudden now there's this flood of new memories. And then all of a sudden, there's this. All of a sudden, you go from the psychological to the spiritual, where Cass brings this kind of a prophetic dream, and I immediately thought of that this was a positive dream, and so again, I'm trying not to give stuff away, but it was. Wait a minute, this is a spiritual dimension too. This isn't just a psychological adventure into the past. This is a spiritual dimension as well. That is going to talk about literally like heaven and hell. And the way you introduced it was clever. I shook my head after. I said, oh, you did well done. Well done. And
That was another kind of ambiguity I wanted to play with because one of, I mean, so Simone, again, she's just coming from a non-religious background. And so one of the things she's inherited from that background is n there's not a clear sense of good and evil, right? So she's just kind of absorbed this sort of nebulous idea of things that are good, but then that can be hard to distinguish between, you know, an idea that, well, whatever is good for you, right? Whatever gives you kind of personal satisfaction or happiness, that's what's good, right? And so she does not have a clear sense of good and evil. Those things are muddled for her. And so when she begins to have these visions, these supernatural visions, it's unclear who's trying to talk to her, right? Like, is this a good spirit or a bad spirit, I guess. Because I don't know if you picked up on this or not, but the novel is a very Ignatian novel in the sense that Ignatian spirituality is about discerning good and evil, right? Being able to discern the good spirit from the bad spirit. And Simone is not able to do that at first. And so I love that you also were in that kind of ambiguous space as a reader, thinking like, oh, maybe this is a good vision. Maybe this is a good spiritual encounter. And then kind of having that turn and realize, as Simone realizes, like, oh, wait, this is not actually good. This is evil.
Well, and the funny thing was, I thought, like, are you playing 3D chess here? Are you, like, having Cass, like, describe the Blessed Mother in a way through a tarot card reader that this is a good... I'm like, okay, that doesn't make sense, but wow, maybe that's really clever that, you know, God can use anyone to speak prophetically and through a dream, even a non-believer who's utilizing a sort of demonic device to get through to her. And then I'm like, oh... Well done. What I actually wrote down in that, in the column, I wrote down 666, and six will get you seven, right? So the idea of, as you know, 666 is that seven is the number of perfection and the number of imperfection is six. Why? It looks like seven, but it just falls short. And in falling short, it's actually the complete opposite. And so I was like, wow, you did such a good job of describing the supernatural manifestation in a way that could be described as a seven to those who maybe aren't spiritually attuned. But in the end, no, wait a minute. It's a six. It's a complete deception, precisely because it looks the most like a divine supernatural positive breakthrough. Mm-hmm. And especially at the end, right, in the second encounter, in the messaging that comes forward, I'm like, you're drawing right from the Gospels. And so it even makes it more like, oh, this must be Our Lady of the Sign in some kind of encounter. And so, again, it was something that was very thoughtful. Again, it made me ponder. It made me reflect. It made me consider. What's showing up, and is it a six or is it a seven? And so I really, really very much enjoyed that about Our Lady of the Sign.
That's really, I've never heard that about six and seven, which I'm going to tell my middle school son that, because there's this meme going around right now about six, seven. I don't know if
oh,
you know
yeah.
this, but I'm like,
right.
What? There's this really deep meaning to this meme. That's hilarious.
Yeah. The number of the Trinity is 777, right? The number of the anti-Trinity is 666, right? So, I want to play off of this some more. This, can we tie some of this back? Because you've written other books, right? The Genesis of Gender is one of them. You wrote a book as well about your journey into Catholicism. And again, Genesis of Gender is available at Ignatius.com as well, so which you can pick up. Yeah. I'm not sure who published your... can they get that as well? They can still get your autobiography, your conversion to the faith on Ignatius.com.
Yeah. So Ignatius actually, there's a second edition. So there's the original edition was Cascade Books, which I believe is also still available. And then there's also an Ignatius edition. That's not really different. I mean, there were some like mistakes that we corrected, and the cover is different. I really love the Ignatius cover, so I think it's a little more readable just aesthetically. But yeah, that book is called Into the Deep: An Unlikely Catholic Conversion, and it's about my own conversion to Catholicism. Yeah,
I think that, like, I felt those themes were relevant and impactful in how you were writing this book. It's a bit of, again, it drew from your experience, but around the other side. Yeah. And so I thought that, but that's really very powerful, because for folks today, a big theme that I tend to highlight in my programs is, folks, we have to be promoting that God made us male and female, because there's an ideology out there that is undermining and weakening the ground that we walk on, and that can lead to not just error, but tremendously damaging things. And I think that that's been a fundamental theme that you were earlier than so many others in your book on the Genesis of Gender. So could you just talk a bit about that, because you've lived through this?
Sure. Yeah. So that's very much the topic of the genesis of gender. So before I became Catholic, my background is, I was raised evangelical Christian, and then in college really went away from the faith, pretty much in all the ways that matter. I went away from the faith. And in that time, basically my 20s, I would got really interested in feminism and gender theory, got a PhD in women's literature and feminist philosophy. And so then when I became Catholic, it was from that direction, right? It was more of a progressive feminist, postmodernist direction. And so the things I was wrestling with were very much the things that it was weird because what both attracted me to Catholicism was how incarnational the faith is and how embodied the faith is and how much there actually is a presence of the feminine in Catholicism. It's not just the masculine. There's like this kind of complementarity between the two. But at the same time, I was very much repelled by, all the feminist objections, like women's ordination, same-sex marriage was a big one. So a lot of my questions revolved around the Catholic theology of sexuality, right? That those are how all of those sort of intersect. And so in my conversion, I really wrestled with that. And then came, and the way I describe it is just like my way of seeing fundamentally changed. Like that's really what the conversion was like. And especially when it comes to things like sexuality and the body and gender. And so those themes are in Our Lady of the Sign, they're in my memoir, they're in the Genesis of Gender. Because all of those works in different ways try to articulate a Catholic way of seeing, especially the body and reality, as sacramental, right? I mean, that's really what Simone, the protagonist, awakens to is the reality, is that reality is sacramental.
Well, Dr. Again, I have the pleasure privilege of interviewing Dr. Abigail Favale about her wonderful novel, Our Lady of the Sign, which again, I highly recommend. So, Dr. Favale, as you're reflecting here on this theme, I find it very striking. Again, what you just shared was a fundamental approach to helping conversion occur in the writings of John Paul II. So, he wrote a book after the Second Vatican Council that was called Sources of Renewal. And in it, he's talking about how to implement the teachings of the Second Vatican Council. And in the first chapter, he says that conversion is not, first of all, our actions or our deeds, but those get traced back to our attitudes or our way of relating to things. But that level of conversion actually gets traced back to the most fundamental conversion, which is our consciousness or how we see things. And you just laid that out so beautifully that in your own journey, it was a transformation of consciousness or a renewal of the mind. And as I've attempted to, again, try to help catechize or share the Catholic faith in these matters, it's like, okay, we can try to get people to change their behaviors. Okay. Policy change in the school or in the public sphere, but that has to be traced back to something deeper, an attitudinal change, or how we're relating to our bodies, relating to gender, relating to being embodied. But that's going to be traced back to how we see things. And so I think of books like yours, like The Genesis of Gender, and then translating that into a novel can help sow seeds in those who read to be able to say, wait a minute. I'm beginning to see differently. I'm getting those seeds of transformation of my mindset, how I actually see. And that's where the battle ultimately is going to lie, is at the level of consciousness, at the level of how we see, using John Paul II language. How intentional was that in your own writing of Our Lady of the Sign, or even just your approach to teaching?
Well, I'm definitely very much influenced by John Paul II because in my conversion, when I was really wrestling with Catholic theology of sexuality, I read his catechetical homilies, that's often called the theology of the body. And I didn't and still haven't read a lot of the kind of pop versions of the theology of the body. But the original source of the theology of the body is just incredible and so rich. And I have not read Sources of Renewal, but I love that, that his influence on my own faith is coming through even maybe without me realizing it. But it was intentional. I mean, I did intentionally want to portray Simone's conversion because it is really a novel about conversion. It's not like a neat didactic novel about conversion. She doesn't like end up like genuflecting in front of a crucifix at the end, like it's not, her story's not tidy up, tied in a neat bow at the end. But in terms of conversion as like a change in how she sees, like that's what really happens. Like how she sees all of reality, how she sees herself and her own body, how she sees her past, how she sees these encounters that she's had in the course of the novel, like all of that has changed. And so we kind of leave the story then with her conversion becoming very conscious, like she's aware that that things have changed, that things have shifted. But I very much did want to portray it as a change in how we see or interpret. I guess interpret would be another way of saying it, right? Because so here's something that frustrates me sometimes in conversations that I have, especially in kind of academic circles, but there's a lot of emphasis on lived experience, right? Well, we have to listen to our lived experience. You hear this a lot in conversations about gender. And what frustrates me is not that I don't have a high view of experience. I think anyone reading my work will see I'm always drawing on my own experience. The experiential realm is very important, but people often talk about lived experience as if it doesn't have to be interpreted, as if it's just self-interpreting, almost like how fundamentalists talk about the Bible, but actually the narratives or the frameworks that we have for interpreting our experience very much shape how we see them. And you see that in Simone's life. Like she's adopted, for example, these narratives about what success looks like for a woman, what happiness looks like for a woman, narratives about the sanctity of life or the lack thereof, like narratives about abortion, narratives about sex, right? So she's adopted these certain narratives. And so she interprets her own experience through those narratives. And part of the novel is coming to realize that those narratives are bad. Those narratives actually have misinterpreted her experience. And so the kind of truth of her experience has to like break through those bad narratives. And that's part of what's kind of happening in the book.
So I'll say two things. I'll say these things to you. I don't normally say this kind of stuff on the radio, but John Paul II, you mentioned some of the original source material. So my PhD is in systematic theology, and my principal area of studies was hermeneutics. And so John Paul II, if you probably discovered a collection of essays called Person and Community, if you have especially the essays towards the end, the first half, they're very philosophical, but the second half, he gets quite a bit into the meaning of a communion of persons and how marriage is a communion of persons and family is a communion of persons and the personalistic norm, these sorts of things that, in fact, it's always been my contention that the theology of the body is not understood well, those catecheses, unless you've really studied the person as gift. And that's understood much more fully in these other essays. And in fact, if I had to point people to one, like the final flowering of his teaching on this, it's not the theology of the body catechesis. It's his papal letter to the family, to families in like 1992, which is so profound. And it actually is a more mature thinking, or maybe even like the later version of Love and Responsibility, where he adds in a lot more commentary. Those are really just incredible, and I use those quite a bit when I've helped young people like discern a call to marriage and what does that look like. So that's my first comment. The second one, and then I'll let you respond, is Principles of Fundamental Theology by then Cardinal Ratzinger. He says hermeneutics must be rooted in ontology, right? So if we don't have an interpretive framework that has a rooting in what is ultimately real and a metaphysics that shows what is real, then we're going to will be free floating, and lived experience then doesn't have a grounding. So there you go. How's that for an interesting conversation in your novel, Our Lady of the Sign?
Well, I'm excited to hear those sources, because, you know, often when students or someone will ask, like, where should I start with John Paul II? And I'm like, well, you know, here's this giant book that's actually pretty hard to read. He can get, you know, it is very rich, but very, very dense. And I've taught it, and it's a hard text to teach. So that's, I'm definitely going to look at those sources you mentioned to see if there's a clearer distillation of some of those ideas. And I love that hermeneutics has to be rooted in ontology. I mean, that is exactly, that's, you know, saying in kind of technical theological language, exactly what I was trying to say, but it's helpful to have that shorthand. So I might have to use that in the future if I, especially when I'm giving a talk, you know, and sometimes I'll get questions afterward where, you know, someone is like, well, what about lived experience? Right. But the way we read our experience has to be rooted in what is real, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what you're
Well,
thinking.
And this is all the way back to the fathers of the church. It was Origen who said that objective knowledge is most fully experienced by being immersed in the object, not by standing apart and looking at it, right? The more scientific approach. But unless you're truly immersed in it and having union, right? A personal union with something gives you the deepest knowledge of it. And so, again, that is a beautiful theme that I see playing out in Our Lady of the Sign, right? So you have to come back to that, folks. Abigail and I are kind of floating off into other conversations, but very relevant. So, folks, this is the kind of stuff that actually will come from reading Our Lady of the Sign.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating. I want to get into the scenes where she stumbles into Mass.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's following Adam's mom first, doesn't know who it is, and ends up in church. And it's the mom that's there. And the way that you described Mass from an outsider's, like a foreigner's perspective, was so fascinating. And it's like, gosh, for Catholics, for us to think that through and to say, what would that be like to do that? That's the first thing. And then the second thing is that becomes one of the places where, to quote an Augustinian concept, the capax Dei, that capacity for God, that ache in the human heart that makes us wonder, makes us point to a transcendent dimension that is simultaneously attractive but overwhelming. Those things you also point to, it touches her experience. She becomes aware of it, doesn't know how to interpret it, and then kind of gets reimmersed in her life. And then it touches it again. And one of those places that happens is in this realm of the sacred at Mass.
Mm-hmm.
How conscious were you of using those kind of themes in writing the book?
Yeah, this would be another instance where I'm very consciously using those themes. So, yeah, so she ends up in Mass. I mean, again, she's wasn't raised Catholic or anything. She goes in there because after going to her hometown, she suddenly becomes like obsessed with the idea of finding her first love who still lives there, right? So she knows that he was raised Catholic, his mom's devout. So she kind of goes there to, his name's Adam, to sort of scope out, maybe to figure out where he is if he does still live in town. And so she's being kind of a creepy stalker. So she ends up in Mass and not knowing what's going on. And so I very intentionally was trying to, I mean, the fancy term is defamiliarization, right? To take something that is familiar, but then tell it in a way that defamiliarizes it. So shows it in a new way to be something kind of strange. And I did draw, you know, I tried to kind of dig deep and try to think, okay, well, what was it like before I was Catholic? Because I would have experiences going into Catholic spaces where I would find things where I found very beautiful and attractive. And there were things that I found really repulsive. So I had a strain. I still remember how I used to feel like, oh, wow, look at this statue of the Blessed Mother. Like, that's so beautiful. And then, ooh, here's this like pamphlet about like abortion. Like, oh, that really bothers me because I'm, you know, I don't believe in that. And so I tried to sort of draw on those experiences and think, what would someone who has no frame or context, what would they see? What would they notice? What would seem weird? What would be appealing? What would seem strange? And so I tried to really bring bring those elements in to make it realistic and not overly pious, right? Because obviously, as a Catholic now, I'm like, I love the Mass. There's so much going on. It's so beautiful. But I can't just, force that on the character, right? So I wanted to
Well,
like get across that there's beauty there and she's glimpsing it, but also it's not this like immediate, getting zapped by the Holy Spirit kind of moment.
I and when I read those descriptions in particular, and then the encounter with the priest, and the second time that she goes to Mass is, I thought of J.F. Powers, and some of his priest characters. I first thought, oh, Flannery O'Connor, but I like, well, no, that's a little too out there, because it was a little somewhat like when he says, "Here, take this holy water, take this blessed salt. This is really powerful." It had a bit of the like a grotesque, quote unquote, right? The bit of the that approach of saying, "No, he's not Bing Crosby and the Bells of St. Mary's priest." But I again, I found that very endearing. To see the way that the priest is presenting a truth that's incredibly powerful and relevant to her in a way that she doesn't even quite understand, and yet she receives what he's saying while also rejecting one of his approaches about go to confession. And yet it was a way to convey a truth. It was a way to convey a reality to her that again I found very enjoyable in how you unfolded it.
Yeah, that's great. I like the priest. The priest is such a small character, but I did try to make him, like well, one of the features of the novel is that the whole thing unfolds over, I don't know, a course of maybe 4 to 5 days, and it's all in the week up to Christmas. So that's the very end of Advent. It's a very busy time for the priest. So he's a little bit like, yeah, what you're describing sounds really intense, but like I'm super busy. But here's some, so just a little bit of realism about what it's like to run a parish,
Well, there was some of the dramatic elements as well, like what's going to happen to Simone, and so you've got Peter floating off in the background, and you've got Adam in front, and then you have Miguel coming in, and I enjoyed Miguel because he's very much a Saint Michael character, and I didn't know if that was intentional,
That was
but
intentional. That was intentional.
okay, yeah, that was a little
I mean,
closer.
half intentional because there's this moment where one of the conversations he has with Simone, where he's like smoking a cigarette and he like grinds the cigarette butt under his feet. And I did actually not make that intentional, but I had a friend who read it and she's like, "Oh, I loved what you did there about the Saint Michael imagery." And I thought, "Oh, that's perfect." But it must have just been like, a kind of intuitive thing. But yes, the name is intentional. He is kind of a Saint Michael figure.
That's funny. Like your friend, I thought you did it on purpose. So that's
That one,
nice.
like, yeah, it was accidental.
That's a nice surprise. Well, I have a dozen different ways that you talked about this facet of memory and how it impacts our lives. But I'm going to let folks discover that for themselves in reading Our Lady of the Sign, Ignatius.com. I want to shift a little bit, unless there are other things you want to talk about this particular novel. That you are an active writer beyond what you're writing in through this novel on your Substack. And so, folks, if you're enjoying this conversation and you want to learn more about Abigail and the writing that she's doing, obviously, there are her books, right? The Genesis of Gender, her spiritual odyssey of her coming into the Catholic faith, and as well as Our Lady of the Sign, all at ignatius.com. But she's writing more routinely. At her Substack, which is becoming an increasingly common platform for writers these days, which I'm excited about. And it's her name, Abigail Favale. So that's Abigail, Abigail. And then Favale is Favale, Abigail Favale.substack.com, Abigail Favale.substack.com. And tell me about what the like how you see that as part of your mission or as an outlet for you.
Sure. So to be totally honest, I have a hard time with social media. I have a hard time maintaining an online presence. And so this is my attempt to do that. But I also know I want to engage with readers and I want there to be a kind of landing place where people can follow my work. And so I just started a Substack with the idea that it will be kind of a monthly newsletter where I send out things I'm doing like this. You know, this will probably be in the next newsletter, like this interview that I did with a link where people can listen, or any pieces I've published elsewhere, I'll probably put on Substack, because I do write essays for other places pretty regularly. And then also to keep readers updated on projects I'm working on now. So I just started work on a new book. And so I'm going to be talking a little bit about that on the Substack. So basically, if you are interested in my work and want to just have us, you know, be updated on what's happening, that's the place to just subscribe there. It's totally free. I'm not monetizing it at all. It's just a kind of landing place for people to follow my work.
Well, and one of the things that I recommend folks about why Abigail is so worth following is that she not only has a history that involves like an immersion and an expertise in the gender ideology debate from the, let's call it the other side. She's gone through the process of having that change of mindset, discovering not just the Catholic faith, but a Catholic way of seeing based in that faith and of being able to interpret the scriptures, having a contemporary understanding of John Paul II in the light of this theory, and then being able to reframe it and to help foster a conversion of thinking, especially, for instance, in some of what you've written about how this gender sex separation is a false structure, and how there is a healthier way of identifying these concepts together. Or even just as a, for instance, your most recent post is on rethinking complementarity from stereotypes to icons. And I just went, ooh, I am very interested in that. So talk a little bit about, just even that, for instance, people here, especially people heard me mention in John Paul II and in recent church teaching, talking about complementarity. As related to the male-female difference. And so just talk a bit about that.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, complementarity is really an understanding of the sexes that I think is a Christian innovation. So if you look at kind of the intellectual history of how we've thought about men and women, you see kind of two main theories, which I would call the unisex theory. You see this even in Plato, which is basically that men and women are kind of interchangeable. Let's emphasize their common humanity, and sexual difference doesn't really matter that much. And on the flip side, you've got polarity, which is like men and women are so different. They're almost opposites, and one is better than the other. And usually that's thought of as men, and men should rule over women because of their difference. And so the Catholic understanding pushes back against both of those extremes by emphasizing both meaningful difference and equal dignity, right? And how that works has played out over centuries as you have different people in the tradition developing different pieces of this doctrine. And it really is most fully articulated in the 20th century, especially by John Paul II. And so anyway, this piece that I just wrote that you can find on the Substack is digging deeply into what the Catholic understanding of complementarity is and isn't, because I think there are a lot of interpretations of complementarity that actually kind of veer toward one of those extremes by maybe overemphasizing difference or denying difference altogether. And so I kind of do a deep dive into how we should think about our differences.
Well, I'm fascinated to dig into it. Because I've thought quite a bit about it, loving John Paul II and his emphasis that we're the image of God, not just as individuals with intellect, will, and now we're adding memory, right? Mm-hmm. But also as, and most fully and perfectly, as a communion of persons. Yeah. And so Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, three persons and one God. Are you going to identify the divine essence as one, or are you going to focus on the three persons as distinct? So you're going to fall into a type of monadism, or are you going to fall into tritheism, right? So there's a mysterious dimension, and so for you to link the concept of complementarity to an icon, I love that, and it's got me thinking, right? Because John Paul II emphasized quite a bit on the feminine genius, and that showed up very beautifully in that papal letter, right? The letter to families, but there was less identified what I call the masculine magnificence. So that men are called to magnanimity or to extend oneself by pouring oneself out in order to accomplish something great for God. And so that idea of the pouring out versus the being receptive, the having that womb-like capacity, it's a way that shows that there's that fittingness, and yet there's that sense of the distinction as well has something very beautiful, something even pointing to transcendence about it. And I know you, again, you get into that in your first book, but to see sort of it continues to advance in your own thinking as well is quite lovely.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to think about still. I mean, even the feminine genius, I think he coined that in 1988 in Moliere's Sunetatum, and I'm older than the feminine genius, I was born in 83, so it's a relatively young concept is what I'm saying. So there's still a lot, I think, for us to do in our time to draw out some of the complexities and richness of these concepts that the church has given us just in the last 40 years.
Right. Well, and to be able to celebrate it, but then also to see that this plays out in married life. So I've been, let's see, married 31 years now. And so as Carrie and I, my wife and I, reflect on the reality of complementarity, it goes way beyond male-female distinction. It gets into how we show up as a couple, as a communion of persons with our family, towards our kids. And how it gives us a point of reflection and sometimes correction around, wait a minute, we're getting out of balance here, where we're settling into this easy distinction to say, well, you're going to lead like this and I'm going to lead like this. And these are complementary, but they're not meant to be exclusive, right? So I'll give you one simple distinction. I don't know how old your older kids are, but there's the what we have come to term the connector and the corrector, where one of the parents loves to connect and I'm with you, the good cop, right? And then the corrector is the one who establishes the boundary, and it's easy to just float in those roles because it makes for a whole, and that's fine until it stops working when the conflict arises and the stresses arise and all of that. And so appreciating complementarity, but also saying that doesn't shoehorn you into one position.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Because what a big feature of Catholic anthropology is the fact that we're not just these kind of static, pre-programmed beings, but we have the capacity to develop our nature, right? We're kind of self-developing like through our actions, right? So even if say something like discipline doesn't come naturally to me because of my personality or whatever, I can develop that, right? I can develop that in a healthy way. Or, if compassion doesn't come naturally to me, I can develop that in myself. So that's another way I think sometimes conversations about gender go wrong, is that they kind of present men and women as these static types where you have to like find one half of traits here, one half of traits here, but actually we can help each other fully develop in places even where we feel like we don't quite have a natural tendency toward one, virtue or another.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Abigail, Dr. Favale, I really appreciate your time. You've been very generous to me, and your baby has generously allowed us to have the
She slept the
conversation.
whole time. I cannot believe this. I've been like just praying. I was like, okay, we'll see how this goes. 60 minutes, she might, but yes, she's a good baby.
It's a sign. It's a
Yes.
sign. So, well, Dr. Favale, thank you. Again, we were discussing your book, Our Lady of the Sign, a beautiful novel. Again, I hope as a result of this conversation, you're going to want to get it at ignatius.com. And again, please check out her Substack, which is abigailfavale.substack.com. Thank you so much, Dr. Favale, for your time. I truly appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much. This has been really fun.